Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths. Excuse me. And today I am really honored to welcome Michael Stallard. Michael, tell me one more time.
Stallard.
That's what I thought. Okay. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I'm honored to welcome Michael Stallard to the show. Now, Michael is here to share his thoughts on the superpower of human connection and the dangers of loneliness and social isolation. And that doesn't just happen corporate level. It also happens for those of us who work from home. We're alone most of the time. So Michael is the primary author of the book, Connection Culture, The Competitive Advantage of Shared Identity, Empathy, and Understanding at Work. And he is also the author of Fired Up or Burned Out. And articles by him and about his work have appeared in business periodicals worldwide. Now, Michael says that today America and other democracies are experiencing what he terms an epidemic of loneliness. And he's going to go in to what that is, and he's going to share strategies to combat that. Michael, good morning. I'm sorry I messed up your name. I was trying not to cough and think at the same time. Can't do both. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. It's good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Denise. It's so great to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity to share our work with you and your followers.
Well, we did a pre-interview. I do this with everybody that comes on my show, and I remember we had an absolutely fascinating conversation. And that's why I said, you know, this is not just an epidemic at the corporate level. There are many, many hundreds of thousands of us working from home. I mean, I don't know about you. I'm a highly committed introvert. I almost never leave my home. Now, I wouldn't call myself lonely, but every once in a while I do feel isolated. So we'll talk about that too. But before we get, you know, into you sharing your strategies and your observations, tell me, is there anything I missed? Tell people a bit about you before we get into it all.
Sure. So my background is I grew up in the Midwest, and after college I joined Texas Instruments in a marketing and then a finance role, and eventually made my way to Wall Street and the New York City area. And like you, I'm an introvert, and I've become more extroverted with the influence of my wife, but naturally I'm an introvert. And I was very driven in my work and with the commute from Connecticut into Midtown Manhattan. And then getting involved in some really challenging mergers, I had squeezed out time for relationships in my life, Denise, and I started to dysfunction. I started not feeling well. I developed some addictions. The wheels were coming off the bus, and eventually I ended up taking some time off just to heal and reconnect with my family and friends. And also, I became interested in, is there a best culture that brings out the best in people? Because I saw that mergers weren't working well on Wall Street because the cultures were different in these merging institutions. And that piqued my interest, is there a best culture? So I decided to take time off. I wrote my first book. I partnered with a few individuals to write Fired Up or Burned Out that came out in 2007. And that led to an interest on the part of organizations to bring us in to do training and consulting. I remember we did 3 years of work at the NASA Johnson Space Center. We've been to Google and Johnson & Johnson. We have a center now based on our work at TCU, Texas Christian University, one of the hottest schools in the country right now. And it's just been fascinating. We do a lot of work in healthcare, but it's really the gist of our work is it's a very simple idea that as human beings, we're hardwired to connect. And yet in this modern age, the workplace has become more task oriented and less relationship oriented. And with technology, people have become they spend even less time in face-to-face connection. So when we're loneliness is a super stressor, it puts us in a state of stress response, which has an effect on our bodily systems. And that's what our work is about, Denise. It's about creating a culture that brings out the best in people and in organizations. So in a nutshell, that's what we do.
And Michael, doesn't that also translate into your personal life? I mean, you said something just now that, you know, even if you're in a cubicle farm, you didn't say that, but that's where my brain went. If you're in a cubicle farm, you're so busy with tasks and, you know, keeping on track and knocking everything off of your list that you don't turn to the left or the right and say, hey, how y'all doing? Now, I see this in, you know, I'll be out and about in a restaurant with friends or even in the grocery store, and I will see couples. Clearly, they're couples. They're married or they're together in some way, and they're glued to their phones. In the grocery store, they're pushing their buggies, glued to their phone, not speaking to their partner, and I'm telling you anymore, I just run into them. I don't even try to avoid them. It's so annoying, but that's because I'm cranky that way. But I find that's horrible. Put your phone down and make eye contact with the person next to you. And I'm finding, just through my observation when I'm out and about, that people are getting less and less alert as to what's going on right around them and who they're with. Now, is this something you're seeing, or is it just me being crabby?
Well, that's a very astute observation. And you know, Denise, there are signs all around us that we're experiencing an epidemic of loneliness. Let me just share a few things. First of all, I always say that artists have their fingers on the pulse of culture, and you're really seeing it in the arts. So, for example, the rock band One Republic just came out with a video in the last month called Connection. You can view it on YouTube. In the first month, it's had almost 9 million views. And it really, in the video, you see it's filmed in the Oculus, which is the transportation hub at the World Trade Center. It's the most expensive transportation hub ever built. And you see Ryan Tedder, the lead singer from One Republic, and the band are performing in there, and you have all these people who are walking around in the station. They're looking at their hands like they're looking at cell phones, and he's trying to connect with them, but they're almost like zombies. They're mesmerized with their phones, and he can't connect. And the lyrics talk about feeling lonely and longing to connect with people, but struggling to do that. That song has become so popular, Jeep bought the rights to it, and they're using it in their advertisements. So you may see the band in Jeep ads. Well, you can see them. They're actually online on YouTube as well. And then you see it in Dear Evan Hansen, which is a Broadway show. It's the second most popular show on Broadway behind Hamilton. And it's about a young man who has some social challenges and anxiety, and he's longing to connect in high school, but feeling like an outsider and just the pain of that. It's a beautiful show. Netflix has a new hit out with Jonah Hill and Emma Stone. It's a 10-episode series called Maniac. And at the very beginning of the show, the narrator says, human beings are, you know, designed to connect, but they don't know it. And so, you know, we drift toward loneliness. And so the thesis of the show, Denise, is what happens if human beings never figure out that they need to connect. And so they dysfunction. They experience greater anxiety and depression and mental and physical health problems. And society keeps going in that direction. And then a pharmaceutical company comes up with a drug that helps people feel better. And the show really goes on to, over this 10-episode series, show what happens when people don't figure out that they have this need to connect and society is falling apart. Now, researchers are also seeing this. Just let me cite two things, and then we can move on to another topic. The insurance company Cigna did research. They surveyed 20,000 adults with the UCLA Loneliness Scale, and they found that the average American falls into the clinically lonely category. And the youngest Americans are the loneliest, and they become least lonely as the older generations are less lonely than younger generations. Secondly, there's a researcher from Brigham Young University, Julianne Holt Lundstedt, who did two huge studies. They're called meta-analysis studies of studies. And what she found was that that Americans who, the respondents in her studies who had higher, greater social connections had a 50% reduced risk of early death. And that those who reported they were lonely, based using the same scale for the most part, the UCLA loneliness scale, they had a risk of early death that was associated with smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And it was a higher risk than the risk that's presented by obesity. So you see it in the art, you see it in the data that, you know, we're struggling with loneliness. We're hardwired to connect, and we're going to dysfunction if we're not intentional about connection.
Well, that makes sense. When I first started out, you know, I always knew somehow, even before there really was an internet that was easily accessible to us, I just knew it in my gut and in my soul that I would work from home using a computer somehow. Don't ask me how I knew. I just knew. Maybe I forced it into being. Who knows? No internet as we understand it now. There was no GUI, graphical user interface. There might have been a forum or two or a chat room or two. I never went into chat rooms. I considered them probably dangerous places. But what I did discover really quickly was that I was isolated, big time isolated. I was a web developer. I still am. I was doing a lot of work for my clients. And then, of course, when the internet and social media came along, it really took off and I started working with social media. But I recognize now that I was truly isolated because I had nobody to help train me. I had to do it on my own. Everything I learned on my own. There was nowhere I could go, and I mean nowhere. I got my computer science degree, and I was on my own. Once I started being able to connect on social media platforms and, you know, working with people, creating friends, creating communities, all of a sudden I kind of stuck my head up in the air and went, huh, I didn't know that I was that isolated. I'm not going to say I was lonely. Loneliness is foreign to me. I am very happy all by myself. But I was incredibly isolated. And I look back now, and I wonder just how in the world I became so successful with no help at all. So I guess my question is, are you seeing a big difference between isolation and loneliness, or do they kind of walk a parallel line?
Well, the hard data shows, and this is going back to Julianne Holt Lundstedt's research, which I can share a link if you'd like that you could put on your website.
Sure.
For people to access. And her analysis looked at social isolation, so people who are physically alone and people who feel lonely. So they could be surrounded by people, but they don't feel connected to them. They don't feel like those people are really friends or, you know, anyone who has their back. And the research showed that they were very similar in terms of their impact on the risk of early death. So, you know, what's happening in our bodies is, you know, we have being alone historically has been risky because, you know, threats were much greater in societies that were not civil, where you didn't have police powers as much. And so in some ways that's been baked into our nervous system. And so our bodies recognize when we're alone and we don't have people supporting us. And so they send a signal to the bodily systems to say, danger, Will Robinson. You know, if you go back to Lost in Space, you know, danger, this is not good. And it creates this anxiety to reconnect with people. And researchers call it the kind of tend and befriend reflex. When we feel stressed, we look for comfort in others and being in a group that helps protect us. So that settles our nervous system. When we're not, when we don't really respond to that and we continue to be socially isolated or lonely, then our body continues to feel that sense of anxiety. And it's played out both. It affects neurotransmitters in our brain and hormones throughout our body. And I think just as important, it affects the allocation of blood glucose and oxygen. So that when we're stressed, the body over-allocates blood glucose and oxygen to the heart, lungs, and big muscles, which is preparing the body to fight or flee the threat. And it under-allocates those resources to the parts of the brain that where the short-term memory resides, the digestive system, the immune system, and the reproductive system. So, you know, no surprise, we have digestive disorders like tummy aches or irritable bowel syndrome or others because our digestive system isn't getting the resources it needs to be healthy. It's being depleted. You know, those resources are going to the fight or flight systems. But once we're back in a state where we feel safe, when we're around people, we feel connected, then the body goes back to a state of balance that scientists call homeostasis. And then the bodily systems are, you know, they're getting the resources they need to be healthy for a long period of time. But if we're stuck in stress response, it's going to shave years off our lives. And that's what you see in the research.
So how do you know if you're in a stress response? Because a lot of what you're describing, I have actually, I mean, just honestly attributed much of it to just really crappy dietary habits. I mean, we're eating a lot of junk. I mean, a lot of junk. People go through drive-through windows rather than cooking fresh foods. My favorite grocery store here is locally owned, and they source most of their fresh food right here from the Gulf of Mexico. That shrimp is brought in from a boat down in Delcam, and it's fresh that day. I eat a lot of shrimp. The store, and I've always found this interesting, is divided very definitely in two. When you go in one door, it's low lighting, it's wood, not wood floors, but it looks like wood floors. Everything is fresh, it's gorgeous, it smells good. Then you step over to the other side of the store, which is fluorescent lights. It's got the, you know, linoleum floors and all these brightly covered packages. Quite frankly, I think you'd be better off just licking the box for all the nutrients you're going to get. So mm-hmm. You know, I don't shop over there. I mean, I buy what canned goods I need and I avoid the heck out of that. So I've always, there's a long way of saying, I've always just kind of considered obesity and a lot of the growing health problems we have to do with our nutrition. So are they kind of combined, stress response and cruddy nutrition?
Well, that's, you know, once again, a great insight on your part, because they are combined. They are linked. When our bodies and are in a state of stress response, we do look for more comfort food. So we tend to look for higher fat food. We look for sugar because, you know, we will feel lethargic and sugar will give us a short-term boost. But then our body crashes and it's hard on our organs to process the sugar. It's better to eat fruit that, you know, natural sugars that are in fruit are really processed in our bodies over a longer period of time rather than just, you know, like a shock to the system from pure sugar. So it's, you know, that stress response doesn't make us feel well. So we look for ways to cope with it. And the responses are, there are a number of ways people can cope. Unfortunately, they're all addictive. You know, one is through eating high-fat, high-sugar foods. And so people do tend to put on weight. They also don't feel like exercising or being as active, and so that's not good for their bodies as well. Other things that we can do, tobacco, alcohol can numb the pain, addictions to sex or pornography. There are addictions to shopping, to work, to exercise. And the problem with an addiction, some of those things, well, exercise, that sounds like a good addiction on the surface, right? But the problem is when you look at the people who have developed an addiction to exercise, they're using it, it becomes an obsessive behavior that they're engaged in where they need a high degree of it. And it's crowding out time for relationships in their lives. It's taking over their life because they need more and more of the same activity to produce the same effect chemically on their bodies. And so it just takes over their life. That's what addictions do. And if you look at the research, it shows Steve Sussman, who's a professor at USC, did a study of studies in 2011 looking at 11 different behaviors and substances and concluded that 47% of Americans have an addiction to one or more of these substances or behaviors that have serious negative consequences for their health.
Let me ask you this, because you're now impacting your health with, you know, eating junk or overdoing any number of substances or activities, doesn't that further isolate you? Because now, like you said, you're addicted to whatever it is, whether, you know, it's eating and you've put on a crap ton of weight and you don't want to go out in public, your clothes don't fit, you're miserable, it's hard to get a seatbelt around you, whatever the reasons are. So now you're even further isolated and you're beating yourself up. So that's not a win-win, is it?
Well, Denise, I have to say, you are asking such great questions.
Oh. You know,
it's almost like we've orchestrated this in advance, but I want your listeners to know we haven't. It's just Denise's brilliance in picking up on the essential issues. It's amazing you're asking the best questions. But, you know, I've personally been there. You know, when I was working on Wall Street, and there have been times in my life when I have been lonely and I didn't feel well, and I was, you know, one of the addictions I was developing was food, you know, and I blame my mom, who was such a good Southern cook, you know. So it was a blessing and a curse, you know.
Trust me. And by the way, anybody who's listening to this, Southern women, and I is one, we cook with butter. So let me tell you guys, if your wife is saying, honey, well, you want a biscuit, you want butter, she's trying to kill you. You better straighten up. So we cook with butter. I'm just warning you right now.
You're making me hungry.
It's not
you know,
love.
Butter and warm cornbread or,
no.
You know,
gumbo.
Yeah, biscuits.
Gravy.
So, mom was a great cook, you know. And, so, you know, I would go to those things, and there are several things that are happening in your body. It actually is, food does have the effect of, as you're digesting food, going down in the digestive system is stimulating a sense of connection that actually boosts oxytocin, which is a hormone that makes us feel, kind of gives us a sense of warmth. It also comes from hugging or physical intimacy. So, you know, interesting. It truly is a comfort food. And I would add weight. And you know what you just said is exactly true. I was embarrassed. I wasn't fitting in my clothes as much. I just wasn't looking as good. And, you know, I hate to say it, there's some vanity there, but don't we all have a little vanity? And,
we should be able to look at ourselves. Right.
Yeah, I felt embarrassed to go out. You know, my clothes weren't fitting anymore. And, you know, every once in a while someone would make a comment, wow, you're adding some weight or something, you know, and boy, that just made it worse. So it's so true. It becomes kind of a cycle of that reinforces a desire to pull back, to protect yourself emotionally from just not feeling your best or wanting to be out there. And the interesting thing is I just saw research on this. That it was people who it was trainers, athletic trainers, and they said the best single thing you can do to reduce your weight and increase your health physically is to engage in healthful activities to get with a group. That's the number one thing they all recommended. So you know, interesting that it really is. There was some Gallup research I saw that showed if you tried to start exercise programs on your own, I want to say, I wish I had that statistic right in front of me, but I think your chance of sticking with it for a year was in the teens. If you did it with a group of people you didn't know, that like doubled your persistence rate. And if you did it with people you knew and who were friends, your persistence rates went up, I want to say almost to like two-thirds. Would persist for a year. So, you know, once again, connection makes an impact. Yeah, accountability and encouragement, you know. It's one of my business partners is a former All-American middle linebacker, and Jason Pankaw is his name, and Jason always says, you know, he focuses on the accountability. He can be a tough character at times, Jason, you know, blowing his coach's whistle. But it's both. It is accountability, but also encouragement is huge in getting people to continue.
Listen, I do understand that, and you know, I have, I would call them mastermind groups. Some of them are through Facebook. Some of them will get on the phone and do a conference call, you know, once, twice a month. But it's the only way we can kind of, it's not the only way, but we have found that it's the best way for us to do these little mastermind calls and say, okay, what did you get done? You didn't? Really? Why not? Nobody wants to be in that hot seat and have to admit they didn't do a darn thing. Not only did they not do what they promised the group, mm-hmm. they didn't do what they promised themselves. You talk about uncomfortable. So those accountability partnerships do work as long as you take them seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, I think as long as they don't become harsh and judgmental, as long as they're accountability with kindness and compassion. And, you know, that's what we find in the best leaders. We, in fact, this afternoon I'm talking to John Rugg, PhD, who did a study of our work on connection cultures and leaders who create connection. And one of the so he did both a master's thesis and then an analytical study for his PhD, for his doctoral dissertation. And some of the values we found that existed in the best, the very best, most effective leaders were, number one, connection. They were able to connect with people they led, and so it brought about a sense of trust. And secondly, you know, what scientists would call, social scientists would call, compassionate love. So it's not like the love of a romantic couple. It's more of a, I care about you as a person type of, is a good way to think about it. I care about people. And you find that in the very best leaders. And the others were wisdom, courage, and oh gosh, now I'm having an early senior moment right on air here.
Well, I know you
talked.
Forgetting
the last one. Yeah.
Well, I know you talked. We talked. I took a lot of notes when we spoke during our pre-interview. And I know that one of the things you said that I wrote down, because I thought, okay, that makes sense. I do this with my own team. We work all over the world. I've never met one of them. Most of them have been with me for 10 years or better. But that tells me that I'm a good leader because, and you said this and I wrote it down, in your words, you have to be able to communicate and inspire a vision and value people and give them a voice. So let's talk about that, because I think that is so important, especially when you're working, as I am, isolated. I'm here in my little home office. Seriously, I try to never go anywhere if I can avoid it. I don't like to go out and about. But the thing is, I have this wonderful team, but I learned after a lot of trial and error and trying to keep things close to my chest, which does not work, that if I give them this big picture overview and then ask for them to help me with it, it all fell into place. So let's talk about that a bit. You know, your
sure.
vision plus value plus your voice equals connection. I would love for you to talk on that.
Yeah. So, you know, what we found in our research, you know, the first, just to back up one step, we found that leaders who created cultures in an organization or a team that were the most effective, and they continued to be effective over time in producing results, they were intentional about tasks, but they were also intentional about relationships. And that's where we saw people describe it as they had a sense of connection with the leader that really made them want to give their best efforts. They wanted to do their best job for the team. And they were less focused on self-interest and more focused on the success of the team and pleasing the leader who they cared about. And they knew the leader cared about them. And so then when we started looking at what was it that leaders were doing that created that sense of connection, it was, as you just said, it was they valued people as human beings, or they cast a vision that was of a vision that inspired people, and it was usually because it was serving others in some way. It was bringing something good and new to the world, perhaps. But it had a positive effect on people. Secondly, they valued people as human beings and not just mean thinking of them as means to an end, their personal success. Then third, they gave them a voice. And so, you know, let me give you an example of this. One of my favorite examples is the rock band U2. Now, let me ask you, what do you think the average age of your listener is, out of curiosity?
I honestly don't know. I know that I'm listened to all over the world, and I'm big in China, of all places. But if I had to take a guess, I would say between 35 and 65. You know, people who
okay.
are solopreneurs, or they're getting ready to become a solopreneur. You know, people who have, you know, maybe they're still working in their own business, but they're ready to kind of do their own thing. So that's just
okay.
a wild guess. I can't be any more specific.
Okay. All right. Well, let me use two examples then, because I think, you know, between the two of them, they'll connect with different ages. So one is the rock band U2. Now, you know, this is they started as 4, 14, and 15-year-old boys in Dublin, Ireland in the mid-70s. And they weren't very good at that time because Bono, the lead singer, tended to think of himself he tended to scream more than sing. Let's put it that way. And the bass player Adam Clayton, he looked like he could be a music star, but he owned a guitar, a bass guitar, but he had never taken lessons and he couldn't keep time. So there's some serious performance issues, and it wasn't unusual for people to boo them or laugh at them. But the amazing thing is these guys stuck together, and over time they got better. They eventually got a recording contract. And today they've won more Grammy Awards. They received more Grammy Awards than any band in history, and they have the highest revenue producing tour in history, surpassing the Rolling Stones. So they've been wildly successful. You look at them, they're healthy. I just saw them in Madison Square Garden a couple months back, and you know, they could go another decade. So they're wildly successful. And Bono says, you know, more remarkable than their music is the way they work together. And let me just explain that. Number one, their vision, you know, to go back to vision, value, voice, their vision is that their music is about human rights, social justice, and matters of faith. And those are things that are important to them. In fact, three of the four band members really started out in a faith community that didn't appreciate their music, so they left. But, you know, their faith is something that's important to at least three out of four of them. And secondly, they value each other. And you see that in several ways. Number one, they split their economic profits five equal ways between the four band members and their manager. And they've been there for each other through difficult times. When Bono has received death threats because of their music, they haven't backed down in playing songs that are agitating to certain people, racists in particular. And the guys have been there to support him through that. When Adam Clayton, the bass player, who was the one member who was living a fast life, when he developed a drug addiction and showed up to one concert they were filming so stoned he couldn't perform. And these guys have a real passion for excellence. So I bet they were furious at him. They were concerned about him, but they were also furious. And they adopted the motto that no one gets out of this alive, you know, everyone's going to survive. We're going to make sure that everybody gets through this. And they helped Adam overcome his drug and alcohol addiction. When Larry Mullen Jr., the drummer, when his mother was hit and killed in a car accident, just shortly after they started the band, Bono, who's also lost his mother within like 2 years before, Bono was there for him and helped him get through a tough time. So they've really been there for each other. That's one way they show they value each other. Another way is Bono is the de facto leader of the band. He's a megastar. Of course, he's in the media all the time. And, you know, he's a bit of an outrageous character at times. But he's always, if you listen to interviews, he's always talking about his bandmates, not only their talents as musicians, but also who they are as people. And he says, you know, when I'm around these guys, they make me a better person. And they're, you know, we're like a family. And they've been together all their adult lives, over 40 years now. And Bono and his wife, Allie, have been married. They just celebrated their 36th anniversary. They have four children. You know, if you look at Bono's story, when his mother passed away, he grieved alone. He was only 14 or 15 years old, and his dad was so grief-stricken he couldn't be there for him. So it's very difficult for an adolescent boy or pre-adolescent boy, depending, to grieve alone. And so he knew the pain of loneliness. And he's very intentional about developing this sense of family with his own family, but also with the band members of U2. And in terms of voice, they make no decisions, or I should say, any decision they make, if one of the band members or the manager strongly opposes it, they won't do it. Bono says this can be frustrating at times because we all have our own minds, and it forces us to work through our differences, but we believe it produces better music, and it keeps us together and committed to one another. You know, they've been wildly successful. So that's one example. Let me give you a second example that will be much shorter. Alan Mulally. Now, Alan became the CEO of the Ford Motor Company when it was projected to lose, you know, I think it was like $14 billion one year. This would have been back in 2006. They were on the road to bankruptcy. The other major automobile manufacturers actually required government bailouts. Ford didn't, however. But fortunately, they brought in Alan Mulally. And Mulally, you know, vision, value, voice is all there. In fact, I've spoken with Alan and email with him regularly, and he says what we wrote in our book, Connection Culture, is the most accurate description of what happened in the turnaround, most accurate and concise description of what happened in the turnaround of Ford. And Alan really cast the vision. He went back to Henry Ford's vision, which was opening the highways for all mankind, and just how important that is. And so, you know, people at Ford got behind that. He kind of brought them back to the original purpose of Ford. They had strayed and lost sight of how important their work is. And Alan really values people. He, you know, there was a lot of bickering and internal competition in Ford's culture. A lot of people were using humor at the expense of others, kind of cutting each other down with their humor. And Alan forbid that. I mean, I don't know his discussions with people, but he actually forbid that. That's a real pet peeve of his. He feels like it destroys relationships and connection. And he encouraged, you know, let's have one Ford. He talked about the power of teams and working together always works. And he set up these weekly meetings where people had voice. It was called a business plan BPA meetings that happened every week. He encouraged people to speak up, and he eventually got people from one division of Ford to help people in another division if they had problems that were slowing down, you know, producing results. And so it really created this, they were tapping the mindset of all the people in Ford to help solve their problems and get on track. Well, by the time Alan announced his retirement in 2014, so 8 years later, they had had 19 consecutive quarters of profit and rising market share in the U.S. without a government bailout. So wildly successful. Fortune magazine had him as the third best leader in the world the year he retired. So, you know, there's another example, but you see this pattern time and again in any group that succeeds over time. You will find that sense of connection, and when you go deeper, you'll find vision, value, and voice. In some cases, it's maybe really strong value. So, for example, I spoke to all of Costco's managers worldwide in Seattle. And, you know, their culture they describe as do the right thing. You know, we obey the law. We take good care of our members. We take good care of our employees. We respect our suppliers. And when we do that, we know we'll reward our shareholders. That's their culture. It's that simple. And it shows they value people. They value their members and their employees. They really do take good care of their employees. And, you know, there's a strong sense of connection. They read the book, our book, Connection Culture, and said, even though we're not in the book, that describes us. And so they contacted me, and I spoke to all their managers worldwide. So anyway, you see that vision, value, voice pattern in any group that's accomplishing great things over time.
And like I said, it doesn't have to be a large company. It can be a small company. It can be a virtual company as mine is. So basically, and these are great stories, and thank you for sharing them. I actually don't listen to Bono. I'm aware of them, but I don't know that I've ever listened to their music. I'll have to go check them out. I don't listen to anything much other than Baroque music because that's what gets my brain moving when I'm working, and I'm always working. But the thing is, what I took away from everything you just said was that basically no matter where you are, no matter what it is that you're doing, whether you're a small company, whether you're a solopreneur, whether you're an entrepreneur, whatever it is that you are, make eye contact. And I don't mean you have to physically go see someone to make eye contact, but you have to show up as a human being. You have to show up as somebody who cares, who is going to listen, and who is going to absolutely welcome even differing point of views in order to get to the common goal, whatever that goal is. So is that a good synopsis? Did I miss anything?
Yeah, it really is. And Denise, I'm glad you brought out the point that this doesn't have to be a large organization, because I am also a small business owner. And it's number one, we as business owners, we have to, and leaders, number one, we have to realize we have to take care of ourselves. We have to make sure that that need for connection is being met for us, because we can't give what we don't have to others. And so, you know, once we come from a place of strength in terms of connection, we have our support group, people we care about and who care about us, who have our back, then we're able to reach out and support others. And just, it might be a good time to just share, because I think you open the door here for something that could be very valuable to people. If you're working alone, or you're starting a business, or you have a small business, you know, here, just some things I would think about and encourage each of you who are listening to this. Number one, be intentional about developing that support group. And it's a really good idea to be in a group on a weekly basis that you can share your highs and lows with. You know, here are things that went really well this week, and here are some struggles I'm currently. We all have struggles, and it could be personal struggles, but you need some people you trust who you can process life with. And that has a huge positive effect on our nervous systems. It makes us more resilient. When we don't have that and we're lonely, loneliness is a super stressor that puts us in stress response. So we really need to be intentional about having that. Another thing is, never worry alone. That's a good phrase to just memorize. When we start to worry, find a friend that you can process it with and just, you know, share. Here's what I'm struggling with. And here's what I'm thinking. You know, what's right, what's wrong, what's missing from my thinking? Someone who cares about you and hopefully has some wisdom on the topic at hand. Even if they don't, it's still helpful. But that actually has the effect of engaging the rational part of your brain and quieting the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that makes us start to feel panicky and threatened. Another thing to keep in mind is, when we feel the emotions of others, and Denise, I listened to your podcast, and it's such a marketplace of ideas for small business owners. But and you say you're hyperlinear, which I'm sure you are, right?
I am.
Good at what you do. But you know, you have such a nice voice. I just also sense
that you are
able to attune to people's emotions. And
well, I'm
an
empath, and that's not something I talk about.
Okay.
But, yeah, there you go.
Well, that's it.
I just outed myself.
I'm glad you said that, because, you know, I sense it. I sense it just in hearing how you respond to your guests. And because you have the ability to do that, you have what's called mirror neurons in your brain, as we all do, or, you know, except sociopaths, not narcissists and Machiavellians, who are called the dark triad. But most of us, the average person, has mirror neurons. And when we are able to feel the emotions, attuned to the emotions of another person, it draws us together. It connects us. And if it's a positive emotion, if I can celebrate your success, then it enhances your joy when you sense I attune to your positive emotion. If I can attune to your struggles and the pain you're feeling, it diminishes your pain. It's like a sharing of pain that helps your friends and people you care about. So empathy connects us. And I hear that in you in the podcasts that I listen to.
Thank you.
So, and then once again, Vision Value Voice is a really simple yet profound formula for creating this sense of connection among a group. And it's all, you know, as we like to say, connection is the force that transforms a dog-eat-dog culture into a sled dog team that pulls together.
Oh, that's, I'm writing that one down. But, you know, here's the thing. I think many of us understand that there's a connection between all humans. I mean, there has to be a repository of human knowledge somewhere, you know, whether it's in the Akashic records or wherever it is, whatever you believe in, it's out there somewhere. Listen, there are no new ideas, right? If you've thought of it, five people probably hundreds of miles or thousands of miles away from you have the same exact thought. It's just whoever is going to take action on it is going to get there quicker. But the thing that I find, and you said something really important, is that when you are celebrating other people's wins, listen, I don't have any competition as far as I'm concerned. I am constantly curating content from people who are in my same area, my same arena. They're web developers, they're social media marketing experts, they could be anything. And if they've done something that I think is fantastic, I will share it. I didn't have to have that idea. But this is information that my audience needs, right? And I am genuinely happy for them. And I wish more people were like that instead of going, well, yeah, but he's stinking rich. What the heck does stinking rich mean anyway? I don't get this kind of animus that people point at other people who are doing a little bit better than they are on any given day. I think it's dangerous, and I think it contributes to your loneliness and your isolation. So am I on the path there? What do you think?
Oh, you are, absolutely. And so, you know, our mindset is very important to our long-term success and well-being and thriving in life and in our work. And the mindset that you see in these super connectors, the Alan Mulally's, I don't know Bono, I know Alan, Francis Hesselbein, Vern Clark, who really changed the culture of the U.S. Navy when he was chief, you know, other people we've written about, is, you know, they're very generous people, and they don't really look at, you know, I think they see people as unique. They never sense people as competitors of theirs, so they're willing to be generous. And they're all about, you know, how can I help others, and how can I share knowledge and encouragement that helps them succeed. And that always comes back to them. It comes back in just the joy they have in seeing others succeed. But also it comes back in practical ways. People want to help them and look for ways to help them because they care about them. You know, one of my old bosses was Chuck Schwab, who founded and started the discount brokerage industry. I mean, he really had a huge impact on financial services. And, you know, he's a very generous man, kind. I wouldn't say... I'm sure there's some competitiveness, but it's like John Wooden, the basketball coach. He really he called it competitive greatness, which wasn't really beating someone. It was about achieving something great in life that challenged them. That's what Wooden called competitive greatness, and he instilled in his players and his team. And that's what you see in these people who are real winners across the board in life and in their work, is they don't really worry about other people from a competition standpoint. They're out to do something great in life and accomplish something they can be proud of. And they know that they can't do it alone. And so they surround themselves with people who have the talents, but also the character like theirs to really help one another and pull together as a team to do something great. So what you said really resonates with me.
And something you just said too, and it's a standalone word, unique. I think that so many people of us don't really recognize or understand just how truly unique we are. We may be working in the same arena as thousands of other people, but we are unique. We have our own viewpoint. We have our own way of offering information. We have our own voice. And I think if people were to concentrate on that and like and love and respect themselves, it's much easier to go ahead and put that out to the world.
It is. It's so true. And I think the faster you can get to that point in life, number one, you're just going to enjoy life more. You know, don't look at the success of others around you. Focus on who you are and who you were made to be and find your calling in life. And then if you can lean into that and have the humility to reach out for help and help others, you know, have a generous spirit and humility, then you're just going to be more successful and enjoy life. And, you know, it affects our biology too. So our research is showing that.
Yep.
It's going to affect your health as well and your lifespan.
It does, and I have noticed that in the way I operate. And, again, you said something very important. When I first started out – I'm a high-functioning sardonic introvert. Sarcasm is my second language. And I always thought if I reached out to anybody for help or for advice, I was showing a sign of weakness. Now, how stupid is that? And it took me the longest kind of time to get over myself. My grandmother would say, get over yourself. But it took a long time. And I find now that if I've got, you know, any kind of a, maybe it's a sticky problem, maybe it's temporary, maybe it's a little bit more long term. If I reach out to friends, people I trust, and say, look, this is going on, and I have no idea what path I should take, you know, do you mind chatting with me? I mean, people will show up in droves. And I have found that people genuinely, for the most part, want you to succeed. Not at their expense, obviously. That's a whole different talk. But they really do want you to succeed. And if they can help you, they will. And I find that in solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, we are some of the most generous-spirited people on the planet. Do you find that as well?
You know, and I do. I think, you know, it's, I love small business. I love small business owners. And I believe that a lot of the problems that we're facing in America now are really going to be solved through the innovation of small business owners, because it's going to create a marketplace that will, you know, create jobs for the middle class. And, you know, right now we have this tension because I think, you know, we have become disconnected, and people do become, when there's greater social isolation and loneliness, they become more risk averse because we become protective. We kind of hunker down to protect ourselves. But it requires, I love what Peter Drucker once said. He says, whenever you see a small business, just remember that someone was very courageous to start that. I believe that's absolutely true. So, of your listeners and you, you know, we're creating businesses. We need to encourage and support one another. And it's just going to be a better future for our children and grandchildren and the country we love and around the world if we are willing to take the risks. And we need that. We need to support each other because taking risk is hard and it's stressful. And there are difficult seasons we face in life. And I think I had shared with you, you know, there's one when I started my business within the first year, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer and advanced ovarian cancer. So her chances of survival were less than 10% that she would survive for 5 years. And we did aggressive, you know, the regular chemotherapy at our local hospital, and then we signed her up for what at that time was an experimental program called intraperitoneal chemotherapy at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. And going to Sloan Kettering, our first visit, we're walking down the street, and the doorman locks his eyes on Katie and greets her like a returning friend. He flashes her a big smile. Now, this is very unusual in Manhattan that anybody even makes eye contact, so it really jumped out at me. And we walked in the lobby. The receptionist is calling everyone honey, also very unusual in Manhattan. And the people were upbeat and optimistic. Our oncologist spent an hour with us. I remember she told Katie, don't look at the statistics because you're not a statistic. And by the end of the day, I had done the research, and I knew they were one of the best teams in terms of their competence. By the end of the day, I knew they cared, and I felt a sense of connection to them, and it just made me more optimistic that we could get Katie through this, you know, a really difficult season ahead. And our daughters were just 12 and 10-year-old girls at that time. And, you know, this year we celebrated Katie's 14th year of being cancer-free from advanced ovarian cancer, and now Sloan Kettering is one of our clients. In fact, Katie and I, we're doing a workshop in a couple months for new supervisors there to teach them to create a connection culture that's life-giving.
You did share that with me, and I'm so glad that she is well. Look, ovarian cancer is not one that you often come back from. So that is
it's a huge story.
Yeah, it and is. The, you know, passed from it.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, we had one of the things that really helped me that it was eye-opening to me, too. I didn't realize how lonely I'd become working on Wall Street. And, you know, it is a hyper-competitive place, so you don't tend to have this. I was fortunate to have some supportive relationships that I really treasured. But it, leaving Wall Street and taking some time off to support Katie through that, we just had tremendous support of our family, our friends, and our healthcare workers at Sloan Kettering. And it just boosted, it made me more optimistic that we could get Katie through it. And it really made a difference in, and we see that in the data on healthcare research, that patients who do have that sense, they do have a connection and support. They have better patient outcomes than those who don't, who are struggling with loneliness or social isolation.
Oh, no question. And listen, even now, you know, with all of this, I'm just going to call it what it is, nastiness. It's going on, you know, social media, government. It's just, so much of it is just horrible and it's nasty. The other day I was in a local business, and I won't say who it was, but I was in there and I can't remember now what the complete exchange was, but this very young, I'm going to say he was a millennial, you know, I said, well, thank you for, he said, oh, thank you, sweetie, and I went, what? And I instantly whipped around and I chased him down. I said, you made me smile, thank you. And it took him aback a bit. He thought I was going to yell at him, which I thought was just pathetic. But I said, no, I smiled all day long. I thought it was the cutest thing. And he was just, well, I just like to make people happy. I said, well, you did. Thank you. And I'm telling you, for the rest of the day, and I was alone for the rest of the day, just me and my feline office assistants, which is how I typically, and, you know, that little boy, he was really very quite young. If he was 18, I would be surprised. And he was just so darn cute. And he made me smile all day long. Telling you this story right now, I'm smiling again. So sometimes, you know, when you know somebody cares, he's doing a job, it's a retail job, it's not going to be the one that he retires with, but he loved it. And he made sure that his customers, consumers, people that passed through the door understood that he was happy to see them. Now that made a connection, right? I'll never forget that, kid.
It does,
I never will.
It does make a difference, I think, when you... No question about it. What we're talking about, it not only affects employee engagement and the effort and energy and enthusiasm they have for their work, but, you know, customers sense that. And it makes you want to come back to a place when the people you interact with on the front line, when they're smiling, when they're enthusiastic, when they truly want to help you, when they truly want to serve their customers, those are the places that are the most successful. It's you know, so these things are all linked to our success as business owners.
And I'm going to assume that his attitude at some level is rubbing off on his fellow employees. It would have to.
It is, yeah. The research does show that emotions are contagious, you know, in part because of what we talked about earlier, those mirror neurons. So when you're around enthusiastic, upbeat people, it does have a positive effect on you. It produces energy that just helps us do our work better.
I've always known that, and I go out of my way to avoid negative people or people who are complaining or miserable. I can spot them, I can smell them, and I'm gone. I will not stick around.
Yeah, it's... you know, and just getting into that, I think when you drill deeper, you know, oftentimes when you look at this whole area of connection, our family patterns have an effect on, you know, it's really, it affects the part of how our brain is developed, the relational patterns that exist. Number one, there is some effect that's passed along genetically. And, you know, scientists have, there's a whole field called epigenetics that really looks at that. And then the social environment that we're in around our families, you know, when we cry out as a baby, does mom or a caregiver come and respond to us? That affects the development of our nervous system. The other thing that affects our development is have we experienced trauma, because trauma does damage part of the brain that makes us misinterpret things in our environment as threats that are not really threats. So the typical, you know, a standard example is the war veteran who's coming back and hears a car backfire, and his subconscious mind interprets it as a you know, as danger, right? It takes him back to the battlefield and what he or she experienced, and so it instantly puts them in stress response. So that also happens. The number one source of trauma in our society is sexual abuse. And that does affect people's ability to connect. And it's really only, I remember I was interviewing a neuroscientist at the National Institutes of Health who had discovered the part of the brain. He was one of the people who really has made contributions to understanding how trauma affects the brain. And we were having breakfast at a diner, and I asked him, Ted George is his name, and I said, Ted, what's the number one source of trauma? And that's when he shared it was sexual abuse. And I said, what heals the damage? And he said, it's only one thing, it's love, it's relationships. When you have people who are supportive in your life, who care about you, who you care about, and by the way, it has to go both ways. You have to care about them, and they care about you. It produces an effect on the body that heals damage that's done from trauma, not only to the brain, but to the ends of our chromosomes, start to unwind from stress. There's two researchers at the University of San Francisco, won a Nobel Prize for it. They discovered an enzyme called telomerase that's released from different activities, one of which is friends and connection releases this enzyme in our body that heals stress damage done to chromosomes. So it's amazing how our bodies need that support. So anyway, too much science this morning probably.
No, not really.
But I find it fascinating.
Actually, well, you and me both, you actually unintentionally responded to the question that I was going to ask and didn't ask yet, and which is, what can we do about it? And you just wove that in there beautifully. So thank you for that. You read my mind.
Well, thanks. I do find it, and I want to reiterate it again. I said it quickly just a few minutes ago, but to get the greatest benefit of connection, we need to, it's two ways. It's not, we just can't be the recipient of connection. We have to connect with others. And this is one of the great findings of the late John Cacioppo, who is the head of the Center for Social Neuroscience at the University of Chicago. And it reminds me of one of the leaders I wrote about in the Connection Culture book, Francis Hesselbein, because, you know, Francis is Peter Drucker, the first management consultant, called Francis the greatest leader he had ever met. Drucker worked with, he knew Alfred Sloan, who founded General Motors. He knew Dwight D. Eisenhower. He knew George Marshall. So to say Francis is the best leader he's ever met, that's quite a statement. And so if you look at Francis's Twitter handle, it's to serve is to live. And that's so true. When we serve others, when we care about others, when we look after them, we also, it helps us live. It conveys that benefit of connection on us. It draws them to us. So I just find that brilliant and so inspiring that Frances, who saved the Girl Scouts when she was head of the Girl Scouts, there was a period when they were dying out as an organization, and she came in and totally revived it. So it's an amazing, inspiring story that's in the book. But check it out if you're on Twitter. To serve is to live. That's Francis's handle.
Definitely. Listen, Michael, thank you so much. This has been absolutely fascinating. I've been scribbling notes like a crazy person. Tell our audience where they can find you and where they can find your book.
Sure. You can buy Connection Culture. It's easiest to buy it online at Amazon or other online retailers. You can learn more about our work at connectionculture.com. You can email me at mike@connectionculture.com. And then I also have a personal blog, michaelleestollard.com, that also includes a video of my presentation to Costco warehouses managers worldwide is on that site.
Great. Michael, thank you so much. It has been a great pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful tips and the advice that you've shared with our audience, and I know they will appreciate it as well once they listen to this and hopefully listen to it again and again. So before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Michael, thank you again.
Well, Denise, thank you. And thank you for all you do to just bring this knowledge, this marketplace of ideas to business owners.
Thank you.
Virtualnow.com.
Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.